So this week we're just kind of taking a break from, we've finished the Apostolic Fathers, that generation who, I'll move this over here, the generation of teachers who had been trained by the apostles. And the early church, you know, first three centuries, was constantly bombarded with problems. Challenges from outside and challenges from inside. This week we're going to look at the challenges from without, the challenges from outside, which are the persecutions. Almost from the beginning, the church faced the challenge of persecutions. Who were the first persecutors of the church? The Jews. We see that in Jerusalem. We see the martyrdom of Stephen. We see the martyrdom of James. But the Jews could only go so far. It's like they would persecute the Christians when there was a governor that had died and there was no Roman representative in place. But yes, the Jews were the first persecutors. The next persecutors would be the Romans, the Gentiles. What were some of the ways that the Christians were perceived by those around them? They were called atheists. Why would they be called atheists?
Because they didn't believe in the Roman gods.
They didn't believe in the Roman gods. They only had this one god that was invisible. Okay. Can we have some handouts on that side? Okay. So they only believed in that one invisible god that, you know, the Romans couldn't control. They were accused of cannibalism. Why would the Christians be accused of cannibalism? The Eucharist. They claimed to eat the body and blood of their Christ. Never mind that it was a metaphor. You know. They were accused of sedition and being disloyal to the government because they had secret meetings. You know, they met and non-believers didn't go to their meetings. They were accused of incest. Why would they be accused of incest? Brothers and sisters in Christ. They called each other brother and sister and they, you know, greet each other on the street and kiss each other. Instead of, hi, how are you? It's you again, eh? So, the church, you know, as holy as their lives were being, they left perceptions to those around who were not interested in what the church was saying. The first persecution, government persecution we see, and we're going to be going from AD 64... all the way to 311 today. Hopefully we'll get through it. First government persecutor was Nero. He ruled from 54 to 68. He was the one when, you know, in Romans 13 that Paul says to be in submission to the government. Nero was the government. And Nero would end up having Peter and Paul executed in Rome. Nero came to the throne through his mother's treachery in 54 AD. She killed her husband, who was Nero's stepfather, Caligula. At first, he was compassionate to the poor, but later he just became obsessed with seeking his own pleasure. So he ruled from 54 to 68, so not long. He claimed to be a poet and an artist, so he wanted to look cultured to those around him. On June 18th, AD 64, fire broke out in Rome. The fire lasted a week. It destroyed 10 of the 14 sections of Rome. the 10 of the 14 boroughs, I guess. Suspicion fell on Nero. You know, there was a rumor, oh, Nero started it for his urban development campaign. So Nero had to do something to squelch that. They noticed that two sections that were spared by the fire were largely inhabited by Jews and Christians. So Nero blamed the Christians for the fire. Nero's wife was Jewish. So the Christians got the blame. Soon persecution spread against Christians for the fire at first, and then because, oh, well, Christianity is an illicit religion, an illegal religion. Rome has not approved Christianity. They approved Judaism, but not Christianity. So from 64, for the next couple years, Nero had Christians persecuted, and it was largely centered around Rome. He was deposed in 68. His own vices caught up with him. The people hated him. He was deposed and committed suicide. And incidentally, his mother got him installed as emperor. When she started telling him how to run the empire, he got tired of it, and he had her assassinated. There was nothing good about Nero. So he was deposed in 68 and committed suicide. The persecution backed off a little bit, but laws were in place that made Christianity illegal. Still an illegal religion. So there's those laws on the books. So the next one we talked about was Domitian, 95 to 96. Now remember, Domitian is the one that sent John to Patmos. And he's the one that Clement of Rome talked about the first section of his letter. We're sorry we couldn't write to you sooner because we had this problem. It was persecution going on under Domitian. It's interesting that Domitian still thought that Christianity was a sect of Judaism. So Christians were just kind of weird Jews. And this persecution was primarily targeted against Jews. He had given orders that the annual Jewish collection, their normal offering, which would be sent to Jerusalem. They didn't have a temple anymore, but they were sending the offering to Jerusalem for the Levites. He ordered that their offering be collected and taken into Rome for the upkeep of the Temple of Jupiter. What do you think the Jews thought of that? They refused, rightly so. They refused, so he authorized the persecution against the Jews. Let's get rid of the Jews. Let's kick the Jews out of Rome. It was a persecution, and the Christians were caught up in it. But it only lasted a little over a year, and it was restricted to the city of Rome and some of the Roman colony cities in Asia Minor. Domitian was so far out there, he was seen as a tyrant by the Roman citizens. His Praetorian Guard murdered him in his own palace in the year 96. So, and they hated him so much, his name was removed from all decrees and documents. So let's get rid of the memory of this emperor. He was no good. So murdered by his own guard. And right at, you know, after he was done away with, guess what? The persecution let off. Then we have Clement writing to the Corinthians and taking care of their church split problem. So any questions? Okay, the next one. See, we have 60, the 60s, the 90s. The next one we talked about was Trajan. Remember who was killed under Trajan? The guy that wrote those seven letters, Ignatius. Ignatius of Antioch was caught up in it. Trajan essentially had a don't ask, don't tell policy concerning Christians. He comes into the office of emperor, and they still have these laws that say Christianity is illegal. He's got better things to do than to go, you know, he has, you know, conquered Jerusalem. He has better things to do with his time than to go chase down Christians. So he set a policy that, okay, we're not going to go actively persecute them. However, if someone brings charges against them in a court, they'll be prosecuted. So that was his policy. So he reigned from 107 to 120. And you have another paper with you, which is Pliny's letter to Trajan. Okay, Pliny was the governor of Bithynia over in Turkey. So he's from 111 to 113, and while he's governor, he's having people, you know, bring accusations against other people, saying, "Oh yeah, these guys are over here are Christians. You need to take care of them." So by government policy, he has to do something about it. And he writes this letter to the emperor for advice how to handle this Christian problem. So the letter starts, "It is my practice, my lord, to refer to you all matters concerning which I am in doubt. For who can give better guidance to my hesitation or inform my ignorance?" Buttering of the emperor. "I have never before participated in trials of Christians, so I do not know what offenses are to be punished or investigated or to what extent. And I have been not a little hesitant as to whether there should be any distinction on account of age or no difference recognized between the very young and the more mature. Is pardon to be granted for repentance? Or if a man has once been a Christian, is it irrelevant whether he has ceased to be one? Is the name itself to be punished, even without offenses, or only the offenses perpetrated in connection with the name? So, if they call themselves Christian, is that enough to punish them? Meanwhile, in the case of those who were denounced to me as Christians, I have followed the following procedure. I interrogated them as to whether they were Christians. Those who confessed, I interrogated a second and a third time, threatening them with punishment. Those who persisted, I ordered executed. For I had no doubt that whatever the nature of their creed, stubbornness, and inflexible obstinacy, surely deserved to be punished. If you don't do what the government says, you need to be punished. There were others possessed of the same folly, but because they were Roman citizens, I signed an order for them to be transferred to Rome." So he could not, under law, put Roman citizens to death or flog Roman citizens. So he has Roman citizens on the list that are supposed to be Christians, so he just has them shipped off. Appeal to Caesar. "Soon accusations spread because of these proceedings, and, as usually happens, and several incidents occurred. An anonymous document was published containing the names of many persons. Those who denied that they were or had been Christians when they invoked the gods in words dictated by me, offered prayer with incense and wine to your image, which I had ordered to be brought for this purpose together with the statues of the gods, and also cursed Christ, none of which those who are really Christians can, it is said, be forced to do. These I thought should be discharged." Okay. You offer incense to the images before the image of Caesar and denounce Christ. Off you go. But notice he says, "I don't think real Christians can do that." Others named by the informer declared that they were Christians, but then denied it, asserting that, well, they had ceased to be some 3 years before, others many years, some as much as 25 years. "Oh, I was a Christian 25 years ago. I quit." Yeah. So, "They all worshipped your image and the statues of the gods and cursed Christ. They asserted, however, that the sum and substance of their fault or error had been that they were accustomed. Okay, now this is key. Here's a glimpse into the practice of the early church. The sum and substance of their fault or error had been that they were accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and sing responsively a hymn to Christ as to a God, and to bind themselves by an oath not to do some crime, but not to commit fraud, theft, or adultery, not to falsify their trust, nor to refuse to return a trust when called upon to do so. When this was over, it was their custom to depart and assemble again to partake of food, but ordinary innocent food. Why would the Christians meet the first, they would meet the first day of the week, why would they meet before dawn?
In secret?
Maybe, in secret. But people could see them. Any other reasons why they might meet before dawn? And then they got together for a meal at the end of the day.
Is it because they were thinking of Christ rising from the dead?
That's possible. We see in Acts that the Christians began worshiping on Sunday, the first day of the week, in honor of the resurrection of Christ. But this is before dawn. Realize that at least a third, if not more, of the Christians at that time were slaves. Their whole day was spent doing the will of somebody else. Their available time was before dawn, when you couldn't see to do your work. So the Christians would meet when it was available. So they met before dawn, and taking an oath together, not to do some crime, not to commit fraud, theft, adultery, not to falsify their trust, nor refuse to return a trust. You know, what is this? It's not clear. He's gotten it from people who have recanted. It may deal with the Eucharist. It may deal with, you know, the encouragement to holy living. So, this is what Pliny is telling Trajan. This is what I found out about them. This is what they do. They meet together before dawn, so they're not hurting anybody. And they worship. They sing a few hymns and worship Christ as a God. And then they're basically binding themselves together in holiness. So that's why they're so evil. So when this was over, it was their custom to depart and assemble again to partake of food, but ordinary and innocent food. So they're not eating babies. They're not eating the literal body and blood of Christ. They're eating real food in their evening services. So Pliny, as the governor, is really confused. Okay, why am I persecuting these people? They're not doing anything wrong, but it's illegal. So even this they affirm they had ceased to do after my edict, which in accordance with your instructions I had forbidden political associations. So some of these people who recanted their confession of Christ had quit when he issues a proclamation, okay, no political gatherings. So, but, you know, a church worship service became a political gathering. Yeah, three people together, well, you might have a rebellion. Accordingly, I judged all the more necessary to find out what the truth was. Okay, he wanted no more. By torturing two female slaves who were called deaconesses. I thought this was interesting that at this time in this church in Bithynia, he's able to find two slave girls, slaves being doulas, and they are accorded the title deaconesses, diakonai, in this church, whether it was an official office or just the function of these ladies. So he tortures these two women, but I discovered nothing else but depraved, excessive superstition. I therefore postponed the investigation and hastened to consult you, for the matter seemed to me to warrant consulting you, especially because of the number involved. For many persons of every age, every rank, and also of both sexes are and will be endangered. For the contagion of this superstition has spread not only to the cities but also to the villages and farms. But it seems possible to check and cure it. Christianity is spreading. What I do? It is certainly quite clear that the temples, which had almost been deserted, have begun to be frequented, that the established religious rites long neglected are being resumed, and that from everywhere sacrificial animals are coming, for which until now very few purchasers could be found. Hence it is easy to imagine what a multitude of people can be reformed if an opportunity for repentance is afforded. We've got these Christians on the run. We have more business in the temples now. He's looking for the good old days. So he's written this letter to the emperor. What do I do about this problem? I got Christians coming out of the woodwork. They're all over the place. What do we do? And Pliny says, you observe proper procedure, my dear Pliny, or Trajan says, you observe proper procedure, my dear Pliny, in sifting the cases of those who have been denounced to you as Christians. For it is not possible to lay down any general rule to serve as a kind of fixed standard. They are not to be sought out. If they are denounced and proved guilty, they are to be punished, with this reservation that whoever denies that he is a Christian and really proves it, that is, by worshiping our gods, even though he was under suspicion in the past, shall obtain pardon through repentance. But anonymously posted accusations ought to have no place in any prosecution, for this is both a dangerous kind of precedent and out of keeping with the spirit of our age. Isn't it wonderful that, you know, even back then, the government bureaucracy kept copies of correspondence. But we get a glimpse of what's going on in the government, also a glimpse of the early church. So what do you think?
The spirit of our age.
The spirit of our age is always, you know, the problem.
The way they worshipped, the limit of it, did they think they could get away with just that bare bones of going through motions? I mean, there's no substance. Did they ever talk about bodies?
Well, remember, he's gotten this from people who said, oh, I used to be Christian, but I'm not anymore. Mm-hmm. But what he's saying is they have done nothing that's really criminal. You know, they get together early in the morning, they sing hymns and worship Christ. That's what we do. There's nothing that is, you know, seditious. They're not trying to overthrow the government. And their behavior is commendable. Yeah. So
survive?
The government. They keep copies of everything. And also, you have with, you know, the emperors, they had historians that would write everything. So anything happening in Roman government, files would be kept. It's just like government today. Okay, so Trajan, 107 to 120. Don't ask, don't tell. That was his policy for Christians. And you see, on again, off again, the persecution is happening in waves. Next one is Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius, he ruled from 161 to 180. Under him, Justin Martyr was taken to Rome and executed. I guess you would call him Justin the Apologist first. He was also responsible for the martyrs in the French city of Lyon. So his was the first empire-wide government-sanctioned persecution. with Trajan, it's, you know, Rome and Asia. And let's not go after them. With Domitian, it's Rome and Asia. With Marcus, it's the whole empire. He was a very superstitious person. He was a Stoic, which is a Roman Greek philosophy taught by the philosopher Fronto. Emphasis in Stoicism was placed on virtue, logic, and reason. The philosophy was concerned with the cosmic determination versus human freedom. So everything exists in a balance, and we have to conform our wills to what's going on with nature. It's a little bit, yeah, we see a little bit of New Age in there. The will of man must be maintained in accord with nature. So he's got this weird philosophy. Fronto biased Aurelius against Christians to the degree that any natural or man-made disasters that happened during his reign were due to the growth of Christianity. So you've ignored all your old gods, and you know, the Christianity's growing. That's the cause of all our disasters. If crops don't come in, that's the Christians. If we have an earthquake, it's Christians. Fire in a city, it's Christians. It's all Christians. If a volcano erupts, Christians. This would be the first empire-wide persecution. Justin would be taken to Rome and executed. And at the end, we're going to take a look at the martyrs of Lyon. A little close-up look. City of Lyon, France, had a thriving church. And at least a third of the Christians in that church would be killed, as well as most of the leadership. And it's because of the orders of the emperor. So that was 161 to 180. The next one, Septimus Severus. I keep thinking of this guy in a black robe with long hair. Septimus Severus. So that's Septimus. That's interesting. The Romans could name their kids all sorts of things. Septimus means he was kid number seven. So, kid number seven, Severus, 202. That's really about, he didn't last long. But under his persecution, Leonidas, the father of the Alexandrian theologian, was killed. When the police came to arrest Leonidas for being Christian, he was a bishop in the Church of Alexandria, or an elder. They're dragging him off down the street. Young Origen has it in his head that to be a martyr means you're instantly saved. That guarantees you going to heaven. So he's chasing down the street behind the policeman and his dad, saying, take me, I'm a Christian. And they laughed at him. So, and this is happening throughout that city, but, you know, Origen would, you know, grow up, become a theologian, not always a great theologian, but he would become a teacher of the Bible in the city. There's another story about Perpetua and Felicitas that happened during Severus's reign that we'll look at. He became emperor in 202. Why did he want to persecute Christians? Well, he wanted to reclaim the glory of classical Rome. Make Rome great again. He wanted religious unity throughout the empire. He realized that, okay, we run the whole world, but look at all these religions we have. You know, we've got the Jews over there, we've got Zoroastrians over there, we've got, you know, Greeks over here, and everybody's worshiping something else. So he wanted to promote a syncretistic religion, you know, a combination religion. let's combine it all together, make one religion for the whole empire. And all were to worship, you know, he agreed, all were to worship the one supreme God, Sol Invictus, S-O-L, first word. Next one is I-N-V-I-C-T-U-S, Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun in the air. So, again, worship the creature rather than the creator. Of course, there's two groups of people who refuse to follow this made-up religion. Who do you think it would be? Jews and Christians. Because of this, the emperor outlawed any conversion to Judaism or Christianity. So, conversion was punishable by death. So that's where we have the martyrdom, the story, the martyrdom of Saints Perpetua and Felicitas. And this was a story that the church wrote up in one of the towns. Perpetua was a young nursing mother from a wealthy family. Felicitas was her pregnant slave. And the story shows how they're supporting each other in the persecution. Perpetua is about ready, oh, I've got kids. I can't, you know, I cannot keep claiming to be a Christian. And Felicitas encourages her. Perpetua would die for being a Christian. Felicitas was allowed to give birth and hand off her child to somebody else to care for, and then she was killed.
There's a mountain along the coast in Oregon.
Yeah.
Called Cape Perpetua.
Cape Perpetua. Somebody remembers their church history. There were three male martyrs associated to who were encouraged by Felicitas: Saturninus, Revocatus, and Secundulus. In other words, Secundulus, that's kid number two. So the story revolves around these five, two women, three men. All five were executed in the arena because they were recent converts, and they were going through catechism, preparing for baptism. So they were sentenced to execution by wild animals in the local arena. So obviously they were, you know, they were ready for capital punishment because they converted. So think about it. What did people have to think about in that society when presented with the claims of Christ? You know, to become a Christian, you had to be willing to lose everything. So after Severus died, there was, you know, a little bit of reprieve until 250. We have Emperor Decius, 250 to 251. And again, he had a desire to restore Rome to its glory days. You know, the empire was falling into chaos and the economy was bad, and, you know, everybody's doing their own thing. We need to, you know, make Rome great again. He believed Rome's problems were the result of abandoning the worship of the ancient pagan gods. So go back to worshiping Jupiter and those others, and we'll have, you know, because that's what they worshipped in the old days, and everything went right. Think about it. Everything's always better in the old days. So he ordered the restoration of the ancient religion. Those refusing to worship the gods were guilty of high treason. If you don't worship the government-prescribed gods, you're a traitor. All subjects of the empire were ordered to go to a designated place in their communities. So everybody, you go to a place in your communities to offer sacrifice to the gods by burning incense in front of an image of Decius. And you swear to the genius of Caesar. Again, the genius was the minor god in place behind the emperor who maintained his success. And the genius looked like a man with wings. So you go, you throw the incense on the fire, say, to the genius of Caesar, and you're given a document to prove that you are in compliance with the law. Again, government, you got to have paperwork. So, and this document was called the libellus, L-I-B-E-L-L-U-S. Christians really had three responses. Number one, they could apply or comply with the government, which would mean apostatizing from the church. Number two, they could lie and obtain a counterfeit libellus. Oh yeah, I got my document, I'm okay. Yeah. The intent was you carry this document around with you wherever you are, and if a government official stops you, can I see your libellus? I want to make sure you're loyal to the government and worshiping the right gods. Yeah, so they carried this paper with them.
Yeah, we have something like that here in Hawaii.
Yeah?
When I first came here, I had to get the special ID card. And I couldn't do anything.
But it was only an identification card.
Yeah.
It didn't say that you had to worship Pele. No. So, yeah, the government wants to make sure the citizens are complying. The third thing that a Christian could do was absolutely refuse to comply, in which case they would be taken off and punished. Decius was really more interested in creating apostates rather than martyrs. Why would that be? It's really pretty intelligent. By creating more apostates, you discredit the movement. It's not worth dying for. What happens when the Christians refuse and they become martyrs? It lends credibility to their religion. And again and again and again, Roman arenas, you have the pagan population, you know, up to 50,000 in an arena, watching Christians stand and be slaughtered by gladiators or wild beasts or tortured to death. And what would they do? They would pray for the people who were persecuting them. They would sing hymns to Christ. They had a hope that the people in the grandstands had no concept of. Tertullian said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. So, Decius didn't want martyrs if he could avoid it. He wanted apostates. Well, he didn't get them. A new title was given to those who stood firm and refused to obey and were willing to go through torture. And they lived through the torture. And this word was, they would be called the confessors. They confess Christ through the persecution, through torture. The next emperor in 251, Gallus, discontinued the persecution. So 250 to 251, not long, but a very bloody time. In 257, Decius's friend Valerian became emperor in 257 and started another short persecution, but he was quickly captured by the Persians and hauled off to Persia. So the church had rest for the next 41 years. Longest period of no persecution for the church. And during this period of rest, we see church buildings beginning to be built. We see more and more copies of Scripture being passed around. Communities turning to Christ. You know, the pressure's off.
seems something that if something like that was going on today, what would happen to us as Christians? What would happen to the church?
Yeah.
Probably start growing again, like it
was. Oh.
Like it
well, it's like in Soviet Russia, religion was illegal.
Yeah.
The Iron Curtain fell, and all of a sudden, here's all these Christians who have been meeting in secret, gathering in forests in the middle of winter to have their morning worship service before dawn, before going off to, you know, work for the state. Their theology wasn't great after 70 years, but there were people who were, you know, genuinely committed to Jesus Christ.
Some guy that used to visit our church sometime,
yeah,
the city bureau boy, he went through all of that.
Yeah.
What you're just talking about.
Yeah. You could be Russian Orthodox, but, you know, you had the government in bed with the church there. So, in Soviet Russia, the term Baptist was a derogatory term. You know, they'd calling somebody a Baptist was a dirty word. But again, you know, it's a modern example of persecution. We have persecution going on in Arab countries all the time. But let's get to the last guy, Diocletian. And we'll get more on him later, but under Diocletian, it was the worst of the persecutions. He came to power in 285 and immediately did away with the arrangement whereby the Senate and the Emperor shared rule. This had been put in place in 24 BC, where you had a Senate and the Emperor, and they balanced power. He closed down the Senate. He created what was called the Tetrarchy, four people in charge of the whole empire. Two would he would give the title Augustus, Augustus. So the two Augustuses were him and his friend Maximian. He took the eastern half of the empire, Maximian got the western half. Under them they had two assistants, if you will, that he called Caesars. His Caesar under him was named Galerius, a Roman general, and Maximian got a fellow named Constantius Chlorus, who was married to a Christian, and who has, you know, we'll learn more about him at another time. Diocletian's wife and daughter were Christians. So early in his reign, there was no persecution. In fact, the persecutions didn't start till the last 2 years of his rule. His Caesar, Galerius, noted that among his soldiers, the Christians were more loyal to Christ than to their leaders. If they were told to go participate in a pagan religious ritual with the rest of their unit, they wouldn't. And there's Christians all over the army. And wherever the army goes, these Christians are creating more converts. So Galerius decided, I can't have any more of that. And he ordered the army to be purged of Christians. So, are you a Christian? Yeah. Out. So first the army is purged of Christians. Well, that wasn't enough. Christians were, you know, Christians were not allowed to be recruited into the army. Then it was Christians could not apply for government jobs. Then Christians in government were kicked out of their government jobs. And this is under Galerius. Finally, at the provocation of Galerius, you know, toward the end of Diocletian's reign, Diocletian issues the first official edicts for the persecution of Christians in March 303. And first one is the cessation of all Christian meetings. Christians can no longer meet together. Next, he ordered the destruction of all churches. 41 years of peace, The Christians aren't meeting in houses anymore. They're having their own building specifically built where they can worship. He orders all Christian churches to be destroyed. Then he orders the deposing of all church officers, elders, bishops, deacons, and this often included just going out, rounding up bishops, taking them off to be executed. He ordered the imprisonment of those people who insisted that they were still Christians after all this. And then finally, he ordered the destruction of all of the Christian scriptures by fire. All the Bibles were to be burned. And you will remember that at that time, scripture had to be hand-copied. The value of a Bible would have been worth more than a house. And there wouldn't be many copies in a church. It would be probably one copy to a church if they could afford it. And the bishop of that church was the one responsible for caring for it. Many bishops died instead of giving over the scriptures to the Romans. Next, there's a new order came down. Christians were ordered to sacrifice to the pagan gods or face execution. There's no negotiation, no middle ground. You sacrifice or you die. Eusebius notes that the prisons became so crowded with Christians at this time, there was no room for criminals. Christians faced the loss of all property, exile, imprisonment, or execution. The fortunate ones who weren't immediately executed were sent to the mines where they were worked to death. In 305, after 2 years, Diocletian, by prior arrangement, retired to go raise cabbages. And as part of the plan, Maximian also stepped down in the west. So the two Caesars become Augustuses. And Galerius continues in the east, Constantius Chlorus in the west. Galerius increases the persecution. Constantius Chlorus never really was interested in chasing after Christians. So in the west, there wasn't much. In the east, it was bloody. In fact, the bloodshed was so constant and so overwhelming that the pagan population began to call for an end to the persecution. On his deathbed, finally, reluctantly, in 311, Galerius issued an edict of toleration. Okay, we're not going to persecute Christians anymore unless they make trouble for the government. So 311, Edict of Toleration. Persecution would cease completely with Constantine's Edict of Milan in 313. So that's the major persecutions of the church, first three centuries. Last thing I want to do, and we have 7 minutes, I want to look at some of the martyrs of Lyon. This comes from a letter the Church of Lyon sent out. And there's a few interesting people. Blandina, a slave girl. Sanctus. Pastor was Pothinus. And another man, Attalus. So here's their story. And I'm going to skip around here. Blandina, in whom Christ was manifest, that the things appear mean and deformed and contemptible among men, are esteemed of great glory with God. So, Blandina, holy life. She's arrested. While everybody's trembling, and her earthly mistress, she's a slave girl, her mistress, who was herself one of the contending martyrs, was apprehensive lest through the weakness of the flesh she should not be able to profess her faith with sufficient freedom. Okay, her mistress is on the fence. Is she going to recant or is she going to confess Christ? Everybody's in the dungeon and near the arena. Blondina was filled with such power that her ingenious tormentors, who relieved and succeeded each other from morning till night, she convinced her mistress to confess Christ. Blondina was filled with such power that her ingenious tormentors, who relieved and succeeded each other from morning till night, confessed that they were overcome and had nothing more they could inflict upon her. They beat her in relay. They could not get her to recant. Only amazed that she still continued to breathe after her whole body was torn asunder and pierced, they gave testimony that one single kind of torture inflicted was of itself sufficient to destroy life without resorting to so many and such excruciating sufferings as these. Yeah. One thing we did could have killed her, and she's still alive. This is day one. Another one, Sanctus, was nobly sustaining beyond all measure in human power the various torments devised by men. So he's being tortured, while the wicked tormentors hoped that by the continuance and greatness of their tortures they would get to hear something from him that he ought not to say. And he withstood them with such firmness that he did not even declare his name, nor that of his nation, nor the city where he was from, nor whether he was a slave or free man, but to all questions that were proposed, he answered in the Roman tongue, "I am a Christian." You know, that was everything to Sanctus. "I am a Christian." For this he confessed instead of his name, city, race, and everything. No other expression did the heathen hear from him. So they go on. At last, they fasten red-hot plates of brass to the most tender parts of his body. He continued unsubdued and unshaken, firm in his confession, refreshed and strengthened by the celestial fountain of living water that flows from Christ. The Holy Spirit sustained him. But his body itself was evidence of his sufferings, as it was one continued wound, mangled and shriveled, that had entirely lost the form of man to the external eye. And he's still alive. When the lawless tormentors tortured the martyr again that day, they supposed that while the wounds were still swollen and inflamed, they might apply the same torments and would subdue him. Beyond all human expectation, you know, it looks like he's dead. His body raises itself. He stands erect among the torments afterwards inflicted, recovered the former shape and habit of his limbs, so that his second tortures became, through the grace of Christ, not his torment, but his cure. So, that's the degree he was tortured. He would die. The pastor, Pontius, who had faithfully performed the ministrations of the episcopate at Lyon, and who was past his 90th year, and very infirm in the body, who indeed scarcely drew his breath, was so weakened to be in the body at the time, yet in the ardor of his soul, in the eager desire for martyrdom, he roused his remaining strength and was himself dragged to the tribunal. Though his body indeed was already nearly dissolved, partly by age, partly by disease, yet he still retaining his life in him, that Christ might triumph by it. When carried by the soldiers to the tribunal, whether the public magistrates accompanied him as if he were Christ himself, and when all the mob raised every outcry against him, he gave a noble testimony. When interrogated by the governor, who was the God of the Christians, he said, "If you are worthy, you shall know." After this, he was unmercifully dragged away and endured many stripes. While those that were near abused him with hands and feet in every possible way, those who are far away are throwing stuff at him. So 90 years old, scarcely drawing breath, he was thrown into prison. After 2 days there, he expired. So that was the pastor. Day two, Martyrus, Sanctus is still around, and Blondina and Attalus were led to the amphitheater to the wild beasts and to the common spectacle of heathenish inhumanity, the day for exhibiting the fight with wild beasts being designedly published on our account. So they were advertising, we're going to have Christians eaten by lions. today. Martyrus and Sanctus again passed through all the tortures in the amphitheater just as if they had suffered nothing the day before. So they're all in the amphitheater. Let's see, Attalus, when placed upon the iron chair, they had a chair made of iron. They heated up over a fire, forced him to sit in it. When he was placed on the iron chair and the fumes from his roasting body arose upon him, he said to the multitude in Latin, "Lo, this is to devour men what you are doing. But as to us, we neither devour men nor commit any other evil." So we're not cannibals. We have done nothing to deserve this. And when asked what was the name of God, he answered, "God has no name like a man." And after these, on the last day of the shows of gladiators, Blondina was again brought forth, together with Ponticus, a youth of about 15 years old. These were brought in every day to see the tortures of the rest. So the last day of this, she's brought in. Force was used to make them swear by their idols, and when they continued firm and denied their percent in divinity, the multitude became outrageous at them, so that they neither compassioned the youth of a boy nor regarded the sex of the woman. They subjected them to every horrible suffering and led them through the whole round of torture ever again. Ponticus, indeed, encouraged by his sister, so that the heathen could see that she was encouraging and confirming him, nobly bore the whole of these sufferings and gave up his life. But the blessed Blandina, last of all, as a noble mother that had animated her children and sent them as victors to the great king, she's tied to a post in the arena. Herself, retracing the ground of all the conflicts her children had endured, hastened at last with joy and exultation at the issue to them, as if she were invited to a marriage feast, not to be cast to wild beasts. And thus, after scourging, after exposure to the beasts, after roasting, she was finally thrown into a net and cast before a bull. And when she had been well tossed by the animal, and now had no longer any sense of what was done to her by reason of her... and now had no longer any sense of what was done to her, by reason of her firm hope, confidence, faith, and her communion with Christ, she too was killed. So this is going on in Lyon, France. Just before the persecution broke out, a young elder at Lyon was dispatched to Rome to go visit the Roman church on some sort of business. His name was Irenaeus. He had been discipled by Polycarp, and essentially sent to Lyon. You know, they need church, they need somebody to guide in the church there. So he's sent as an elder to the Lyon church. They send him on a business trip to Rome. He goes to Rome. When he comes back, all the church leaders are dead. A third of the church is dead, and he's made bishop. And we'll talk about him later. So that is a summary of all the persecutions. We've gone over time. Any questions? I know it can be depressing, but it's what the church faced. The church could have decided, oh, we're going to go ahead and get along with the culture around us and be tolerant. Or they could have gone up in arms and said, we demand our rights, and gone into rebellion against the government. What would have happened to the church if they had done either of those options? Where would we be now?
Would not be.
We wouldn't be. And we have a culture now that says, oh, those Christians are so intolerant. Why can't they just accept what we want to do? Yeah, so. Satan is behind it. He's the prince of the power of the air. But you know, Satan can only influence people in the way they want to go. So.